Good. Thanks very much, and thank you to the Audio Engineering Society for inviting us along. It's a real pleasure to be here and see so many old friends and former students as well in the audience. So that's great. What we're going to talk about, again, Filippo and I are doing a double act tonight on the talk, and we hope we'll spend no longer than certainly an hour maximum on this. Talk a bit about the university, a bit about the ISVR, a bit about the audio team, and we've got all of our students here as was suggested. And we're going to cover some of the topics that we've been working on the research front as listed there, so hopefully you'll find it interesting. The university, you probably know about, is quite a big organisation now. I have responsibility for research and enterprise across the whole thing. Which is great fun, but means I do less acoustics these days, I'll be honest. But we're a sort of top 10 Russell Group institution for our research, getting on now for half a billion in terms of turnover, so it's quite a big operation. 22,000 students, 5,000 staff, 73rd in the world rankings, okay, so we're top 100 students. Our Vice Chancellor says we've got to get the top 50, so that's our strategy, getting the top 50. But we have a strong culture of enterprise, innovation and partnership working. That's a key thing. So we do a lot of engagement across the piece, actually, with business and industry, and we're very committed to doing so. So the ISVR, again, lots of former graduates here, but I'll just quickly talk about the Institute. It will be 50 next year, okay, so 50th anniversary of the Institute coming up. Very distinguished history. It's focused on acoustics and vibrations right from the start. It was founded in 1963 by Elfin Richards, who was a professor of aeronautics at the time. And the big problem in those days was that the comet was falling out of the sky. It was acoustic fatigue. Aeroacoustics was the problem, and it still is, actually. They fall out of the sky so much. In fact, the A380 is an immensely quiet aircraft, thanks in no small part to the work in ISVR. Again, the Institute again has this pretty unusual balance of what goes on. So the education part of it is smallish compared to the rest of it, so it's research intensive again, 50% of the income coming from research grants and contracts. Enterprise, we run a cochlear implant centre and a consulting arm, that brings in about 35% of our income, and so you can sort of see the balance is rather different. It very much is a research institute rather than a standard university department. Four groups, essentially, fluid dynamics and acoustics, which is where Filippo and I are in terms of the work we've done. So it brings together acousticians really from across the board. Again, aeroacoustics, underwater acoustics, ultrasound, and the audio engineering that Filippo and I do as well under that heading. Dynamics, obviously, about vibrations and related subjects. Signal processing and control, a lot of active control work and that sort of thing, which again I was involved in the early days of that. And of course human sciences is our other great strand. We do work on real problems of hearing, subjective acoustics and human response to vibration. So that's the sort of topics. Aircraft noise again. We have a Rolls-Royce University Technology Centre, which I had a hand in founding back in 1999. That's been really successful. And has about 30 people associated with it working full-time on Rolls-Royce's noise problems. So that's no trivial research effort. Again, I mentioned the active control work. That's going back a bit, but there's about 1,000 aircraft now flying around with a system that, in fact, has obviously moved on a long way from the first one that we flew around in, which was great fun back in the 80s, just hanging up loudspeakers inside propeller aircraft and turning the quiet switch on and the noise goes away. That was good, but it's got very much into practical use now, so we're quite proud of that. Ultrasound, there's Professor Tim Layton, who's a great technologist in this area. He does everything you can imagine in the world of ultrasound, from looking at bubble acoustics to the way kidney stones are smashed and so on and so forth. So again, quite a broad portfolio. just an example of some of the Dynamics work, a very successful gadget that was invented by our Dynamics group, a rail damper. These sell in huge volumes now. It brings in substantial sums of money to us, actually, for quite a simple piece of kit that you stick on a railway that stops it making quite as much noise as it otherwise would. And that's been quite a successful piece of work. Very strong effort in railway noise and vibration, ground vibration and work of that sort. So that's just another example. Human sciences, you can sort of see the top picture there, is a new facility we put in. This is not that new now, actually. I was involved in planning a new building which would take in the basement a large six-axis shaker where we can actually do experiments on real human response to real vibration environments, or very accurately simulated vibration environments, I should say. And there's a picture of a car sat on the top of the shaker down there. Cochlear implantation, we now implant, I think it's something like 100 patients a year, which we manage the whole process in ISVR of basically taking profoundly deaf people and letting them hear again, in a nutshell. And that again is a very important strand of work that we do in the Institute. So that again is something we're immensely proud of. So, virtual acoustics and audio engineering. This is sort of something that I do with Philippa Fazzi here, and again, it's the sort of work that's oriented towards the Audio Engineering Society. So the whole business of really reproducing sound and looking at new ways of doing that and technology associated with it. There's about four of us actually on academic staff that really get engaged. About seven research students, many of whom are here tonight. We do a lot of final year projects and master's projects in that field. We've got some visiting researchers. We've actually started a new company as well to exploit some of the technology we've developed, and I'll talk a bit about that later too. The picture of the sphere there, Philippa will talk about much more about later, 40-channel loudspeaker array, and that's been great fun, and Philippa should deserve huge credit for the work that he's done in that area. So more about that later. What I'd like to talk about, I'm going to talk a bit about the science. This is work that's been going on for a number of years now, so some of it's sort of older work, but nonetheless I think quite important work, again in an audio engineering context. So obviously you're all familiar with the hearing mechanism and the basics from the auditory canal into the cochlea there and then into the auditory nerve, following nerve firings in the cochlea, and that sort of bit of it all is quite well understood. It's sort of what happens after that is less well understood. When you get nerve firings starting to go into the brain stem here. That's not the way to do it. Sorry. Right, go into the brain stem. There we go. Around here, some of these sites where you actually essentially get binaural input. So you end up with a signal coming from one ear and signals coming from another ear, and combining in that nucleus there, the olivary nucleus, and we start to piece together the two signals and start to make sense of where the sound's coming from, you know, what the localization is. And we've really set out to try and do some modeling of this process, inspired by that process, so it's a biologically inspired model of how the hearing mechanism works, with the objective of actually helping audio engineers. We have a particular interest in placing virtual sources of sound at places that we so desire, and evaluating these systems is long and tedious because you have to put lots of people in front of the experiment and ask them where the sound comes from. So having some predictive capability in this is really rather important to us. So we set about trying to start from there and see if we couldn't come up with a model of how it all might work. And this is work that was done by one of my PhD students, Moon Park, which I thought might interest you. And essentially, there's sort of three bits to this model of how binaural hearing works. So we have a peripheral processor, where we take that first stage, the auditory canal, the eardrum, the cochlea, and right up to the nerve firings. And we know that reasonably well, and we can come up with a sort of an engineering model of how that works reasonably successfully. The binaural processor we know far less about, but there's been lots hypothesized over the years about how that works. Now the central processor, we're still less clear about how that works, but nonetheless, what we've done is taken peripheral processors that are sort of plausible, had a stab at what might be happening in a binaural processor, and then another sort of bit of guesswork about how the central processor might work. What we've come up with is a model that actually seems to work really rather well at predicting localization when you're trying to get engaged in things like stereophony or producing virtual images with new forms of signal processing. So just a bit about that. The peripheral processor is sort of shown here. If you imagine taking the right ear signal there, as shown on the diagram, if we get the mouse going, there we go. You get the right ear signal coming in, model the middle ear with a bandpass filter. The basilar membrane, which of course does the frequency, filters out the different frequencies, you model with a whole bunch of bandpass filters, gamma tone filter bank, sort of well-established way of modeling that process. And then the way the inner hair cells work, remember in the cochlea you've got these little cells that fire off and generate nerve impulses that go into the auditory nerve in response to motion of the basilar membrane, and you can sort of model that with a bit of half-wave rectification, a bit of low-pass filtering, a bit of square root compression, or I'm using sort of broad engineering terms here, and you can sort of get a replication of what might be happening in the way of nerve firings that's reasonably plausible with a fairly simple model. Then you start doing the binaural processing, and that's where we again borrow from biology to sort of guess about how that might be working. The filter bank, again, I put some of the references down here. The rest of this talk isn't terribly well referenced, to be honest. But the model we've developed so far, and this is one of the topics that we're working on, that Simeon Matez, who's in the audience, is working on, used about 60 filters with centre frequencies in the 300 to 12 kHz range. And so that's really mimicking the way the basilar membrane filters as a function of frequency. Different people have different numbers of filters, so it's as basic as that, really. You can find in the literature lots of papers with different numbers, 44, 40, 104, 40, 23, 31, no one agrees. It's just a representation, roughly, of what's going on in there. So we chose 60, why not? We're still working on what we really need to choose to make all this work, not only in the horizontal plane, but also in elevation, but we'll come back to that in a moment. So if you look at the peripheral processor, which, as I said, is sort of a plausible representation of what goes on, you can imagine left and right ear signals here, and we've actually chosen a low frequency and a high frequency just to look at what nerve firings we get at the output of the peripheral processor. And you can see from the left and the right ears here at 500 hertz, you can sort of see the phase locking of the nerve firings to the signal. So imagine, you're putting these two through a filter bank, so you're just picking out one of the filter outputs, and you can sort of see that you track the signals, and you can sort of see the very clear time discrimination that's going on there. At high frequencies, you can see there's very clear level discrimination, but the time discrimination is not nearly so good. Although when you sort of beam in on that, you actually do get very clear time discrimination here, and also you actually track the envelope shifts. So when you blow it up, you can sort of see the envelope of that signal there, which is expanded in time very considerably, is present in those nerve firings. And that's entirely consistent with what we know about the hearing mechanism, that at low frequencies, it's essentially the timing difference. This goes back to Lord Rayleigh. At high frequencies, it's the level difference, but also envelope shifts are captured at high frequencies, and that's an important feature of this model. You actually get that when you do it this way. Okay, what about the binaural processor or the central processor? Could go on for hours about the way this all works in reality, but we don't know enough about it. So we've actually sort of picked up what some other folks did. Breebart, in fact, was the guy that actually came up with a binaural processor, which actually has a good internal representation of both interaural time difference and interaural level difference cues. Remember, those are the two cues Lord Rayleigh said you use to localize sound. You can take those two and decide where the sound's coming from. And the sort of representation that we've got here is a network of these so-called EI cells, where essentially And this is semi-plausible that this exists biologically. Okay, I'm not going to make any more statement than that. Certainly in avian creatures, it's been established that that's the case. But essentially, you take the two ear signals coming in here, one from the left, one from the right, and if I can make all this work, I think I'm going to get... I may have to embed this properly, but you get the idea here. Let me just try and run this for you. A little animation. Essentially, if you look at this particular cell, these are neurons essentially in that olivary complex. That's the notion that we sort of have here. And you take the two signals and you sort of take the right ear signal there, for example, and send it through a delay, delta tor at the top there, and do the same again. There we go. And again, another delay. And this time you're sending it down that route, but the left ear signal comes in, it will then be attenuated, I think is the next thing, there we go. It'll go around there through a delta alpha, which actually reduces its amplitude a bit. And if you track the other signal coming in, they'll both converge, eventually when I press this button enough times, on the EI cell, there we go, there's an attenuation. And if those two are perfectly aligned in time and amplitude, they will basically cancel out at that cell, and you'll get no output from the neuron. So that's the sort of idea that we've got going here. So there you go. And then essentially what we believe happens is that you square it in time average, and you'll get that sort of result. If I can close this. And you imagine that happening over this whole network of these EI cells, and what you end up with is a pattern here, which is a sort of two-dimensional pattern with interval level difference and interval time difference involved, and essentially that's the output of the binaural processor. And you can sort of see for a source positioned at 20 degrees to the listener's right at 500 hertz, that's the pattern you get, and you can see the minimum relative to the centre of the pattern, I'll get the mouse working, sits there, and then if you change the frequency, the position of that minimum changes, and it becomes less distinct as you go up in frequency in terms of its characteristic time difference, but still distinct in terms of its level difference. And so you can end up getting different EI patterns for each frequency, and that's the sort of notion that we have for that binaural processor. Then what you do is basically pattern match. You say, okay, how good is the brain at detecting that pattern? The whole idea is that you've got some stored recollection of what those patterns are like in the central processor up here in the auditory cortex, and that you basically go through a process of comparing what those cells are doing with what you've learnt in the past. And so you can do all that on a computer with no bother. And essentially, again, a quick animation shows you what's going on here. If I can get this going. Yeah, again, I've got to do this. Apologies for that, but there we go. And you can sort of essentially imagine EI patterns for a given target angle that's being generated. Again, we've got all the center frequencies going up and down the right-hand side there. Remember, we're doing this at all the frequencies out of those 60 filters the whole time. So each frequency got its own EI pattern, and essentially what happens is that you match those templates to what's happening, to what you've stored in memory, I should say. So the pink ones lighting up there are what you've stored in memory, and you start to sort of say, well, it sounds as if the source is located at a certain angle defined by that bottom axis down here. So as a function of angle, you've got lots of different patterns. Okay, so that's the sort of the way this works. I better just close that down now. He says, try that. Okay, so then you do some experiments and say basic stereophony. Okay, couldn't get more basic than this in terms of auditory signal processing. Measure listeners' HRTFs, head related transfer functions. We have a hearing model that imitates the listener with that certain head-related transfer function. move your stereo image by changing the gains on the loudspeakers, all good classical stuff, all right, classical stereo, and look at what happens to the EI pattern as a function of frequency, and you end up looking at the response of the model, which I think is the circle, versus the triangle, which is the truth, and you see at low frequencies it's fine, and as you go up in frequency you start to see this disparity in the position of the image, and as you go up still higher, then you come back to getting good answers again at the higher frequencies. And essentially experiments we did showed you the model prediction for a stereophonic image, which sort of looks like this. So again, if you put broadband noise through a stereo setup, then you're intending to get a 20 degree image, and what you actually get is, as a function of frequency, pretty well 10-20 degrees, except around the sort of 2 kilohertz region where it sort of goes off beam a bit. And again, did the experiments, tested that with real subjects, and essentially, you know, again, properly conducted listening tests, so I won't go through the whole business. And essentially verified experimentally what this model was predicting. And so the model actually ends up giving you quite good prediction of the subjective responses, which is sort of telling you that this model isn't a bad way of actually representing localization in real stereophonic systems. We pushed it even further and did work on stereophony to the side of the listener, for example, and essentially got exactly what you predicted. So that's the prediction of the model. The test results were biased, but you can see the shape is absolutely right, and that just confirms something we've all known for years, that if you try and pan between two loudspeakers to the side, the image will stay at one loudspeaker then suddenly jump to the other one. You don't get a smooth transition of the image like you do when you pan from right to left with speakers in front of you. Bit basic, but the model actually predicts that really rather well, and we're quite proud of that. We did even more sophisticated experiments with different panning around different combinations of loudspeakers here, of different angle ranges, and you can see how the test results actually worked out with the model predictions really quite well. So what we've got here is a model that actually we can use in an engineering sense, and I'd commend this to you. Okay, so you don't have to do quite so many subjective experiments if you're trying to work out how well a given layout of loudspeakers will, when mixed with the right signals, will give you different human responses, at least in terms of localization. Lots more to do than just localization, but that's where we are. That's horizontal plane. What we're working on now is also being able to do it vertically as well, and that's Simeon's project that he's working on. And he's going to be giving, I think, some demos later about some of the software he's been developing to do that. We did it for 5.1, that worked too, essentially. Some conclusions. You only get really stereophonic images as designed at low frequencies. You get individual models, give you reasonable predictions of perceived image positions. We can take that prediction and combine it across frequency to handle localization of wideband sounds. I haven't gone into all that, I'll be honest, because I wanted to get on and talk more about this. And some of you will have heard some of this before too, which is, can we do better than classical stereo? Can we actually deliver not some cunning mixture of signals at the ears, which is what classical stereo does, but actually deliver very accurate time histories to the ears that really do replicate those time histories that you would have got from a source in a certain position? And this is something we've been working on for some time. Getting quite good at it now, even if I say so myself. Basically the idea is this, that if you have a source here and you process those source signals through a dummy head or a computer-based filtering system that represents that dummy head response, and you take those signals and you pass them through digital filters that you invert to make sure that loudspeaker response is taken out of the system and present those signals to the listener's ears, then you will get a response from that listener which is just as if he were here, provided, of course, that head-related transfer function matches that head-related transfer function. Okay, so that's obviously an assumption in that whole thing. Why don't you do that over headphones? Well, these days you can to some extent. The classical problem with that is, of course, you internalize the image. It sounds like it's inside the head. But loudspeakers give you a much better externalization, so we pursued this. And a lot of people have in the past, reference down there. But of course you have this problem of crosstalk, that you can't just deliver that signal to that ear with loudspeakers, you also get that signal coming across, so you put another filter in the network to make sure that you subtract that signal from that one when it arrives at that ear, if you follow the idea. And again, you do it the other side, same answer. You end up with a matrix of filters that you need to design. And we spent a long time actually figuring out how to do that, and again, got quite good at it. Cutting a long story short, there's no equations in this, well, there are two, there's two equations. Philip, there's two equations in this talk. I'm not going to bore you with any of the maths or all this, but it gets a bit tricky, I'm not going to go through that. But the fundamental physics of it is that you do have a problem when that path length difference is half a wavelength, half an acoustic wavelength. And it's difficult to produce in-phase signals at the ears with in-phase signals at the sources, and that's a fundamental problem that you have. So if you take two signals there in phase to two sources, and you look at the signals you get at the two ears here, you can see they cancel out, and there's sort of a nice fancy little animation of that, which sort of shows what's going on as you put the loudspeaker in, signals in at the top, there's a red one and a blue one superposed, they're in phase, and what you get at the bottom is no sound, so it's a problem. Okay, so that's a problem, as I said. And it turns out that if you, however, do have the signals out of phase at the loudspeakers, you don't have a problem. In fact, the reverse happens, you get probably too much sound. So let me just show you that. And you get big signals at the listener's ears when the two signals are out of phase. So there's a whole mathematical explanation for all this, which I'm not going to go through. The simple answer is that actually, if you can get the path length difference to be a quarter of a wavelength, everything is absolutely fine and dandy. All right? You end up being able to take two out-of-phase sources like this and get very nice microphone signals at the ears there. Again, no head in this, it's just a free space representation of what's going on. So if it's a quarter of a wavelength path length difference, all is fine with out-of-phase sources. And even with in-phase sources, where you got nothing when it was a half wavelength path length difference, you get a nice signal of the same amplitude as for the out-of-phase mode. So what you really want is a set of loudspeakers where you put different frequencies out through different spacings. And this is the simple answer to the whole thing. If you have a quarter of a wavelength spacing at low frequencies here, for example, you need to have your loudspeakers quite well apart, spaced apart. And as the wavelength goes down, as the frequency increases, you need to have the speakers closer together. So if you sort of get the idea, as lambda over 4 there, or lambda gets shorter, you need the loudspeakers closer together. And so one conceives of, and this was Takashi Takeuchi, one of my former students who still does this stuff, of the optimal source distribution, where ideally what you want is a distribution of source strength where you have high frequencies coming from the middle and low frequencies coming from the edge, and you can either have it as a line in front of you or wrap it around you. Same principles apply. As long as you get a quarter of a wavelength path length difference, everything's fine, and you get brilliant crosstalk cancellation. And so the first thing that Takashi did, this is going back a long time now, but I'll show you where we've got to with it. The three-way discrete optimal source distribution, where you say, okay, we can't actually do that ideal distribution, but we'll split the frequency range into three, for example, or four or five. Here's the three example that Takashi did for his PhD. High frequencies through a 6-degree speakers, 32-degree speakers for the mid frequencies, and 180 degrees for the low frequencies, and the crosstalk cancellation you get is spectacularly good across all frequency. And that is the sort of work that we've done. Again, a lot of work was done in the anechoic chamber on looking at the effectiveness of that system. Subjective experiments, won't go through the detail, lots of different localization presentations, lots of data. Net result, really good azimuthal discrimination. You can make sound appear to come from anywhere you like in the horizontal plane. If you want sound to appear to come from behind you, majority of subjects will do that if their head-related transfer function is well matched to the dummy head transfer function you're using to process the signals. In elevation, not quite so good. But again, we've got lots to learn about how you elevate virtual sources, and that's why I go back to the modelling process that we're working on that. So that, again, we're very proud of the fact we actually got a product out with Marantz on that, which used that principle. There's others in the pipeline. The recession hasn't done as much good when it comes to all this stuff. People aren't willing to take any risks and do new things, but it's starting to come back again, actually, and people are saying, oh yeah, let's do this, and so that's good. So more products later. So again, got a good write-up from Practical Audio Engineers. And we hope more to come soon. I think that's me done, Filippo. There were some conclusions. There we go. Binaural reproduction, much better virtual acoustic images than conventional stereo. It really is so much better. There's all sorts of good things about the optimal source distribution, but it's still for a single listener, just like conventional stereo. The research challenge here is, can we do this for multiple listeners? And we may have the answer Filippo is working on with arrays and all sorts of clever things. So I'm going to hand over to him now. Thank you.
Right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about our activity, mainly focusing on, well, some focusing on loudspeaker and microphone arrays. And before really looking at what we are doing, I would just like to review some of the basic principles. Assume you have two loudspeakers, and you'd like to focus their energy in a specific point. So what you can do is just calculate the distance and delay one loudspeaker with respect to the other in such a way that the two wavefronts are going to have a lot of animations in order to avoid. You see, we have a constructive interference, if you like, so we focus the energy exactly where we want, just simply by applying some simple delays. This is the main idea behind array processing. In a similar way, if you want to achieve sound cancellation, what you can do is just exactly the same processing, so exactly the same delay, but you phase revert one of the signals, so instead of achieving a constructive interference, we obtain a destructive interference, and we can cancel sound with sound at the cancellation point. So this is the main concept of active control of sound, if you like. So you have a noise source, and with another source or multiple sources, you try to cancel that by using destructive interference. Now, there are really a variety of interesting things that one can do with this very simple concept. So the basic, the physical concept of the array processing is really simple. And the reciprocal process, this microphone array, works also in a very, very similar and simple way. Now, the first step to move from two loudspeakers to multiple loudspeakers is obviously loudspeaker arrays. This is one of our prototype. We think that really this ever a lot of potentially interesting industrial application because they are small. And if they're small, they are much more suitable for the kind of consumer market. You can put them on your laptops, at home, under your TV, and so on. And there are a variety of things that you can do. You can beamforming, binaural reproduction, a personalized audio, and just going to tell you quickly about what we did. So the first concept is, I'm working with this with my colleague Minchul Sheen, who's there going to give you a demonstration later on, and more recently with my colleague Ferdinando Olivieri. The concept here is to have a single audio device that can deliver different audio messages, different audio material in different areas. So they call it sometimes personalized sound zones, personalized sound field, or so on. The concept, obviously, is to try and focus sound here and cancel it everywhere else, and you do a set of separate filters, as they were, for the different sound zones. And what, in practice, if you have a plot of the sound energy, if this is one loudspeaker array, what you do, you create a sound beam in a given direction, here in case in a direction that's perpendicular to the axis of the array, or to a different direction. So you focus your energy. This is the classical kind of beamforming. But we developed, and we are studying, this digital signal processing technique in order to do this to achieve this in the best possible way. This is one of our prototypes, what we built recently. As you can see, they are not very, very large devices. You can see an example in the other room. This is a dual-layer loudspeaker array. We did a dual-layer loudspeaker array in order to control the front and back radiation. And, we use one inch diameter loudspeakers. And What we did, first of all, is to try to measure the so-called transfer function, the Plant matrix, if you can borrow this term from the active noise control theory. So, as you can see here, this is our large anechoic chamber. Light is always yellow there, so all the pictures, most of the pictures are yellow because of the light there. So a lot of rock wall around us, everything is very absorptive. We have our loudspeaker array mounted on a turntable. And we have here a microphone, a single microphone. So what we do, we measure the transfer function for each loudspeaker to the microphone and we rotate then the loudspeaker array at 5 degrees step. So we have a set of transfer functions, so in this case 16 transfer functions measured every 5 degrees of inclination. And this is what we call the Plant matrix, so we know how each loudspeaker radiates sound. To give you an example, this is just one loudspeaker, so if you take for example this loudspeaker here, so this is in the front and to the right of the array, this is the radiation patterns. Averaged over different octave bands, so it's pretty much omnidirectional at low frequencies and very poor radiators, it's a very small device. Then you get slightly more directional, kind of mid-low frequency range, a bit more directional at mid-high frequency range, but we have just, so these are 10 dB per division, so not really a big, really redirectional sources. And then when we are really high frequency, they become very, very directional, as we would expect them to do. But still, they are not very, very directional in this kind of mid-frequencies where a lot of important material is for voice, especially. So what we want to do now is to try and design some digital filter to sort of feed the different loudspeaker with different signals so that we can achieve different bright zone and dark zone, another way of calling them. So assume we have all our loudspeaker array here, and we have, for example, four control points. There are many different ways of tackling this problem. I'm just going to tell you one of the many possible ways. So, 4 points, and let's assume you say, okay, we want a bright zone here, we want energy here, we want no energy here, no energy here, no energy here. We know the transfer function between the loudspeakers and these control points, so all what we have to do is to invert the problem. So we know what we want here, we know the transfer function. Now we have to determine what are the loudspeaker signal that allow us to achieve this objective. And we did that. The mathematics is very complex because obviously it doesn't work well for all frequencies. Actually, it does work well only for a very, very small range of frequencies. But this is what we get. So these three lines represent the bright zone, respectively, and the three dark areas, if you like. And this is radiation pattern. Blue line is a simulated radiation pattern of the loudspeaker array, and the red line is the measured radiation pattern of the loudspeaker array. And as you can see, we get, first of all, reasonably good results between reasonably good agreement between the measured and the simulated radiation pattern. And as you can see, what the signal processing network tends to do is to maximize the energy in a kind of target position and create nulls in the direction of the so-called dark spots, right? And this works very well, I should say, in the mid-range frequencies. Not that well at very high frequency, but this is mainly due to so-called spatial aliasing. So when the loudspeaker are not close enough, then we start kind of losing control in terms of directional pattern that we can synthesize. And if we compare what we can obtain with a radiation pattern of a single loudspeaker, we can really appreciate what a big improvement we've done in terms of directivity. So the green line, dotted line, represents the directivity of a single unit, as we saw before. The red line represents the directivity of our array. So as you can appreciate, especially in middle frequency range, we have a much, much more directional source, if you like. And very interestingly, we can steer it. Now, we have done this exercise for a dark spot in front of the listener, but obviously we can repeat this exercise for a bright spot at 60 degrees or virtually anywhere. Obviously, when we have a bright spot and dark spots, or illuminated area and dark area very close together, then we need a lot of energy in order to kind of create a discontinuity in the sound field. But this is a long story, and it's a very fascinating but I will not go into it right now. So, well, that's what happens. This is a time simulation. So this is, I think it's a 12 channel, a single layer loudspeaker array. And in the time domain, this is what the different sources do. As you can see, they focus the energy here and minimize all the rest of the energy everywhere else. Does it make sense what's happening here? We have some pre-ringing and some post-ringing because we are trying really to maximize in this case the so-called acoustic contrast. But we can try and find, what we are trying to do right now is to find the optimal trade-off between the audio quality and the so-called acoustic contrast, depending on what the application is, what the user wants. But we cannot use the same kind of principle for creating binaural sound, for instance, so we can generate, if this is the is an array, and this is the head of a listener with two ears, a very simplistic model, we can create one sound beam that goes to the left ear and impose a zero at the right ear and use this kind of directional synthesized source to generate the signal for the left ear, and then we can repeat the same exercise for the right ear, those obtaining binaural reproduction, a kind of a multi-channel crosstalk cancellation, which does not use the optimal source distribution that Phil Nelson described earlier on, but a different kind of approach. And this is what happens, again, in the simulation here. As you can see, all the loudspeaker focus the energy here, and the energy is minimized at the right ear. Okay. And we implement all that in real time using, in this case, MaxMSP, as you will see in the demos in the other room. The research challenges now is to define and to achieve the optimal trade-off, as I said earlier on, between the audio quality and the spatial control of the sound field. In some application, I want to prefer to maximize the audio quality, so I have a very nice and clean high quality hi-fi signal, and if possible try to reduce the interferences and try to enhance the acoustic contrast. In some other application you just want some acoustic signal delivered very precisely with no interferences from other sources, so you want to enhance the acoustic contrast and you're not so fussy about the audio quality. This is obviously a very important point. So simplifying the problems and find some simple parameters that we can tweak in order to freely move between maximization of quality, maximization of acoustic contrast is a very important point for our research. Second point, achieve good performance over a wide frequency range. These devices work very well in a frequency range wherein we don't have problem of so-called instability and ill conditioning at low frequencies. And we don't have problem at high frequencies for spatial aliasing. So we are working on all that. Let's increase the number of loudspeakers. Let's use a very, very large number of loudspeakers and assume we want to maximize the energy at a point down here at infinity in a little specific direction. So what we do is we synthesize a plane wave, as you can see. Again, the principle is very simple, just a matter of delay and gain in this case. And this is really the principle behind wave field synthesis, if you like. We obviously didn't invent wave field synthesis, but master students and have done some experiment with that. This is our 40-channel loudspeaker array. It works very fine, real-time implementation. And the students really had a lot of fun trying to understand and exploit all the advantages and disadvantages of an array of that size, which is very large, but not really, really large. So you can read their dissertation if you want. And we did something different as well. We built recently the sphere, so I put a lot of pictures now about our voltage on the sphere, because last week we've done a lot of work with this device. It was extremely painful to build it, and we were working night and days, and so I put a lot of pictures. And this is actually an experiment that we did like in 2008. So this loudspeaker array is actually a spherical array that includes 40 sound sources, which are more or less uniformly arranged on the surface of a sphere. So what we want to do is to try to synthesize a desired sound field. Again, it's a different form of wave field synthesis, but doesn't strange that technology kind of give a brand to to what it tries to achieve. So we are synthesizing a sound field. This is one of the two equations, and assume you have like a control volume as did you do something wrong? No. Please don't fall asleep. That's the response to the single equation. Well, hope the light is gone. But in the meantime, I can continue talking about the equation. Assume you have a control volume, and we know what kind of sound field we want within this control volume, and is given by this function P. And then we have like a distribution that we can assume being a continuous distribution of sources on a different surface here. And the relationship between the sources Q and the field P is given by this integral operator here that represent, if you like, a Plant matrix, a continuous version of the Plant matrix that we saw earlier on. All we have to do is, given P, determine Q, calculate Q, that allows to reproduce the desired sound field. Now, this is really the hardcore of the theory of inference problems. There are mathematicians that wrote volumes about this problem. It's very fascinating. And it's all about the mathematics of integral operators. It's very, very interesting, but I will not go through it now. What I will say is that we can discretize this problem. One way of solving this problem is by discretizing it. So we can discretize the so-called control points in our control volume. We can discretize our sources, and our integral operator becomes a matrix now. And the obvious discretization for the sources is to have a finite number of countable, distribution of loudspeakers. And this is exactly what we are doing with our sphere. So we have a control volume within our sphere, and we have a discrete distribution of sources on the surface of the source distribution, which is in fact this sphere. So this is a simulation of the sound field reproduction system, and this is actually the real implementation of the sound field reproduction system. Just to give you an example, this is a video that was done by Ferdinando. So this is a numerical model, obviously, of the loudspeaker array. This is a sound field due to a single source here, and here two sources. As you can see, as we can create a pattern of destructive and constructive interference, you have more and more sources, more and more sourcing acting in phase opposition. So we can create a variety of different sound fields, a variety of modes, if you like, within the sphere that we can control independently in order to synthesize the sound field that we want to. This is one of the pictures of our last experiments here. Simeon and Diego are setting up the loudspeaker, whilst Mitchell is setting up the microphone array. And if you are interested in seeing what goes on the screen, this is a real-time implementation of our sound field reproduction system that was actually done by Diego. So again, we work pretty much in real-time when we can. And once we have generated a numerical model of the sound field reproduction system, once we have implemented the sound field reproduction system, we want to objectively evaluate its performance. So in this picture you can see that Simeon and Mitchell are setting up a microphone array. They're all BMK measurement microphones, so you can imagine what happens if that microphone array falls. This is why we put so much effort in fixing it. And so what we do, as you can see, this is a kind of linear translating microphone array, and we sample our reproduced sound field on a grid, and the experimental results are these. So, sorry, again, this first turning, just like that, so more than once. And, right, imagine you have a real source inside your loudspeaker array, and this is a sound generated, measured, these are all measured data, generated by this real source in this position. Assume that this is your control volume that we described earlier on. Now, we use all the different sources in order to generate the same or as close as possible the target sound field within the control volume. And as you can see, we can do that. It does not work in the same way at all frequencies. There are a lot of limitations, but we're trying. We do a lot of work in order to get better and better results in this kind of application. And it's very interesting, I believe, to kind of explain briefly how the sound field reproduction, the concept of sound field reproduction as seen in the sound field reproduction system relates to the theory of inverse problems and acoustic holography, for instance. In the case of acoustic holography, imagine you have a vibrating structure that generates a sound field. Now what you do with acoustic holography, you measure the sound field generated by the structure. All right. You don't know how the structure is vibrating, but you have a measurement of the sound field generated. Then you can invert the acoustical propagation and try to calculate from your sound field measurement the vibration field on the vibrating structure. This is the principle of the acoustical holography. Now, you can do exactly the same for a sound field reproduction system. Imagine you have an array of loudspeakers. You don't know what the array are, what kind of sound field the array are generating, but you actually do have a desired sound field that you can impose a kind of your measurement point. So what you can do is to invert the acoustical propagation operator matrix, call it the way you want, in order to determine the loudspeaker signal that would generate the desired sound field. So I hope you can appreciate the very, very close analogy between the two kind of problems. Yeah, the main difference here is that in the former case, a solution always exists because there is a real vibrating structure. In the second case, we are actually just imposing a desired sound field, so the solution, that is the loudspeaker signal that would generate the desired sound field, might not always exist. For example, if we desire to have like signal here, zero, signal, so creating a discontinuity in the sound field, well, that solution would not exist. So there's one of very, very important difference between the two approaches. But obviously, it's not important only to evaluate the performance of our system from a so-called objective point of view. We also do subjective measurements. So in this case, we see my colleague Lara, who unfortunately can't be here today, whilst we are doing subjective tests using a 22.2 system. We don't always work, obviously, with a 40-channel loudspeaker system, but we can also go down to 22 or to 10. In fact, these are standards that are used in Japan and in Korea, in fact, becoming more and more popular in telecommunication. And in fact, one of the most important research challenges is to try to link the physical descriptors of the sound field to the psychoacoustical descriptor of the sound field. In fact, when we have sound in space, we have physical observables which are really characterized by very high complexity. But once the human perceive, actually, that the human interact with the sound field and generate an acoustic scene inside their head, we actually we are here in a spatial sound perception domain, which is possibly characterized by a reduced number of variables, or at least a reduced complexity. So we can, to some extent, characterize the human perception as a psychoacoustic filter, which actually embeds a lossy transfer function. So we reduce the number of observables from a very high complexity to a reduced complexity. So it's not really, we don't really need to control all this high complexity number of variables, but we only need to control these. So it would be very, very useful to set this kind of forward lossy problem and then to invert it. To some extent, the psychoacoustical model that Simeon is developing together with Phil Nelson do address this problem. But there is a lot of much work that we need to do in this field. And obviously, the very important point, the next step in research, is to allow a larger flexibility and robustness with respect to the loudspeaker positioning and room reverberation, because obviously the system I talked to you about work extremely well in a very controlled environment with very controlled arrangement of loudspeakers. As soon as we start changing the things, the performance go down, but not for this reason we have unacceptable solutions. And as I mentioned earlier on, the reciprocal problem is the microphone array. It really works in the very same way. We just substitute sources with receivers and we invert the problem and create a reciprocal, so the time goes the other way around. But this is to say that the theory of microphone arrays and theory of loudspeaker arrays is very, very similar. The transducer behave differently, but once we establish a model, the mathematics to tackle the two problems is very, very similar. This is an example of what we call the SAM, the spherical array of microphones. So this is a very old prototype, and as you can see, not really a commercially interesting product. In fact, it's not a product. And is a spherical array, regisphere, and we have two microphone arrays arranged into spherical sectors. And we use this to measure impulse responses. In fact, we capture, I think there are 15 plus 15, and then the array rotates 8 times, so captures a really, really large number of impulse responses. And this is another example where we've seen that before. Another kind of microphone array that we use is the linear microphone array. Came up some time ago, a very interesting demo of what you can do with a linear microphone array. There is an awful lot we can do with a simple linear microphone array. And just to mention microphone arrays, an important research challenge for us is to develop high directivity microphone arrays that also have a very high sound quality. And on this problem came up at Tonti Watanakul is working in his PhD project, and he has a poster in the other room. One of the interesting application, if we combine obviously the capturing of a spatial capturing of sound, the spatial reproduction of sound, is oralization. So imagine you have the usual problem, a source generating sound in an environment. Well, we can model the radiation of the source by measuring the impulse response of the source, but we can use, for example, a multi-channel microphone array in order to capture the spatial impulse response. And then we can measure in an echoic signal of the source that we want to oralize, as a matter of fact, by combining the two with a complex digital signal processing network of filters, mainly digital filters, we can generate the feeds to a loudspeaker array in order to reproduce the sound field that would be generated by this instrument as if it had been played in this concert hall. We did some experiments. These are our concert hall at the University of Southampton. The organ is not there anymore right now, is it? No, but it's an interesting story. But and yeah, what you can see here, we have an acoustic source here. We do have a measurement system that includes myself here. We do have a microphone array here and a dummy head. So what we did, we captured the multi-channel impulse response of this concert hall, and we oralized some instruments using the multi-channel sphere. The results were very interesting, but we are doing more work on that, and our colleague Diego Murillo is doing his PhD exactly on this problem, oralization, which we think is really very, very interesting for a variety of applications. And the new challenges, especially for oralization, is to have an interactive oralization. So you don't really compute spatial input responses for a specific location of the source and a specific location of the listener, but you try to have a description that would allow for a quick real-time calculation of the oralized field when both the source and the listener are moving. And also, we need more in general, that's an interesting project that we would like to work more about. Hopefully soon we're going to work on that with BBC, to try to represent spatial audio material in a way that is not really bound to a specific reproduction system, but is to some extent, we would like to develop a system agnostic representation. There have been in the past several attempts of doing that, but we would like to do more of that, so that you can have a sound file format, if you like, that would probably could be used to give its best if you use 40-channel loudspeaker array, or if you use a tablet, for instance. So obviously you can't have exactly the same input files or channel-based input files for the two devices. To conclude, I would like to just acknowledge and the all the companies we with which we have been collaborating and we are collaborating. There are a variety of companies in a variety of different markets, starting from telecommunications, first of all, BBC, ETRI, we've been for a very long time partner with Electronic and Telecommunication Research Institute in Korea, more recently with NHK. Consumer audio, we've been working with Samsung Electronic in the past, with Kajima, with Yamaha, NiFi, Meridian Audio, Martin Audio, KEF, some of all of you guys are here, and we're really, really proud to work with all you guys. And obviously, we are working with leading academic and research institution with which we have a variety of collaborative publication. I would like to mention and acknowledge IRCAM in France, University of California, San Diego. And we are proudly partner of BBC, of the newly founded, well, now it's 1 year. Since 1 year, we are partners in the founding members, as a matter of fact, of the BBC Audio Research Partnership. Right, before this concludes my our talk, so I hope you had a kind of comprehensive, fairly long, but I hope not too boring presentation of our research activity. And the next step now, we can move to the other room. And in the other room, we set a variety of one demonstration and variety of interactive, non-interactive posters. So I would like now to introduce the different contributors and authors. First of all, the miniaturized loudspeaker array. So Minchul Shin, my colleague, is there. So if you want, just to... Yeah, this is Minchul. And he's going to run a very complex demo. So we said all this thing worked greatly in a controlled environment. Well, the other side is pretty much a reverberant chamber, right? All kind of nicely brick walls. But we managed to create a multi-zone environment. So we have one loudspeaker array that generates three different sound zones. It's a kind of single layer black one. And then there is another smaller array, which is a dual layer array that generates kind of two zones. One in the front of the array and one in the back. Well, on the two sides of the array. It's hard to tell which is the front, which is the back. And you can see on the floor there are some kind of white, DIY white spots on the floor, which represent the different listening points, different spots. So ideally, if everything works as when we left it, you should be able to step on one of these spots and have predominantly being exposed to the audio material as one of the five different audio materials. If that makes any sense. Doesn't make any sense? Well, I hope you're going to experience that in the other room. Just put your feet on the white spots and try to tell us what you listen. Number two, interactive demo of HRTF features. So Simeon Mattes, and he is, right here is Simeon. Right, so he has a very interesting interactive demo. It's actually a MATLAB simulation with a graphical user interface, and it's very, very interesting to explore the different features of the head-related transfer function, especially when you're using not the conventional azimuth and elevation system, but when you use this kind of what we call a kind of translated system, when you're actually navigating the HRTF on one cone of confusion. So you can see how it changes on a given cone of confusion, and you can look at all the spectral cues and so on. Then we have other posters. This one on microphone array done by Chemapad. There it is. So he's used boundary element method for calculating the effect of the scattering body of a microphone array when you're trying to do some DSP for microphone arrays. Ferdinando Minchul also. Where's Ferdinando? Here is. Here's Ferdinando. So together with Minchul, they put together a very nice poster that covers the background theory for microphone array and loudspeaker. So a lot of things I said, I will not go into that today. They do that in their posters. And the two posters by Juan, who is... here is Juan. So his work is mainly concerned with stereophonic sound reproduction and with the usual problem that when you move from the sweet spots, that the image collapses with that. What can we do in terms of digital signal processing in order to compensate that and in order to generate multiple sweet spots stereo reproduction? He's also going to talk about the project that Lara Harris did together with Keith Holland on developing a measure for low frequency reproduction. Using, I think it's STD, intelligibility measurements in order to evaluate the quality of low frequency reproduction for loudspeakers. That is all. Thank you very much having been here, and I guess we can all move to the other room. Obviously, we are open to questions.